Yeah, sorry, I forgot to record it. Okay.
It appears he got disconnected.
He got disconnected right as he was asking a question. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, all right. Well, so maybe I'll wait till he gets back to answer that question. Right. Right. But anyway, so how are you feeling prepared for this also? Oh, there you are back. Very good. Okay. Right. Okay, yeah, so in answer to your question, I don't know, but I did proctor the last one on Zoom, and I am guessing that that protocol is not so dissimilar from what we'll do again. Now, it's a different person in charge, but so far as I know, that would be reasonable. So what we did last time was, as you said, it was on Zoom. The people taking the exam had their cameras on, a little bit like mine. The setup was a little bit more like this, so that we could sort of see what they were writing. It was kind of the scheme. Then after the exam was over, the students just uploaded it in a couple different ways. So they emailed us versions that they took pictures of, and they also sent it to Gradescope, and then we graded it. Anyway, that was the protocol last time, and I would guess it'll be similar now. Oh, and after the access to the exam, it was a lot like what I've been doing. We shared it on the screen, and we gave a link to it, just as I've been doing, so that you could use either process for seeing it.
Okay, so just pull up the test on my laptop, and then answers on a blank piece of paper?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So the answers were written on paper, and as you say, blank pieces of paper, and then scanned and sent in. That's how it went. And last time we didn't have any issues with disconnecting problems. I was also teaching last fall and on Zoom, and I did proctor an exam where the computer connectivity of one of the main ones, I forget which one, basically collapsed in the Davis area during the exam. So that was an issue, but we didn't have that issue with this exam last time, so. Hopefully not again. Okay. All right. So as I said a moment ago, I was thinking to go back to the exams that we already looked over and make sure that we have that the four of you are happy with writing up detailed solutions to at least four of them, because that's about what it takes to pass. Okay. So as I also mentioned, I'm happy to entertain other thoughts. So let me bring up the exam. Okay. So as I said, these are the ones that we looked at. I'm just going to do them from the beginning. So hopefully they are now more familiar, the problems, than when we first looked at them, because we've done examples. So yeah, why don't you spend a minute or so reminding yourself of these problems, and then we'll just select the easiest ones and make sure that we have solid solutions to those. Okay, let's see. So again, of course, this should be familiar. So just looking at this, what would be a good one to start with? And we can make sure we're solid on that one. So again, we want to do the easiest first. That's the plan. Two, all right. All right, and what would be the approach?
If it has finite dimension over Q, then it has to be a torsion QX model.
Okay. And I guess you're using what, like the classification theorem?
Yeah. Although we could show this just as a contradiction if it had a element that was free, then as a we could keep multiplying it by x, x squared, x third, x fourth, so on, and that would give us infinite dimension over Q.
Right. Okay. So yeah. So we could build that directly.
A torsion module cannot be a direct sum end of a free module.
Okay. All right.
And therefore, it is not projective by definition. Because one of the definitions of a projective module is a projective module is a direct sum end over a free module, or a direct sum end of a free module.
Okay, I would call it a theorem, but all right.
Okay, yeah. A theorem in Dummett and Foot that shows that it's...
Yeah. Okay, so it's projective if and only if it's a sum end of a free. Right, very good, yeah. So you can state this, either call it a definition or a theorem, but in any case, state it, and right, and then those are the steps. Is that clear to everyone? Would anyone approach it differently from that? Okay, so there's one we can get written up. Okay, what looks like it might be next easiest here. Or at least sufficiently doable to approach next.
I would start working on number 5 next.
All right, let's try 5. Okay, yeah, maybe I'll put that on the other board. So, all right, so how might you approach that? Maybe I'll just switch over to the other screen so it's easier to write. Okay, so this is number 5 here. All right, so how would we approach this? So it says has a unique, right? So there are two things to do. We need existence and we need uniqueness. So which of those is going to be a good one to start with?
Existence is not too bad.
All right. So for existence, how do we do that?
1 over n, 2 over n, so on. So k over n for k between 0 and n minus 1.
Mm-hmm. All right, and this is isomorphic to a CN. Okay, good. So we have a subgroup and unique. Let's start this up. So if we have H is a subgroup of Q mod Z with the order of H being N. Okay, so how do we get that that's now the same as the group that we have identified? So we know about the orders of elements of groups.
They divide the group.
Exactly. All right. So if I take... Mm-hmm. Yes?
Every element would have to be of the form A over B. And if we multiply by that, by N, that gives us some integer.
That's right. Okay, exactly. So so H is a subset of the set of things A over B, as you said. And... if A over B is in H, then as you say, the order divides N. So N times A over B is equal to 0, which means it's in Z. Oops, a little box. A over B is in Z, or in other words, B divides N, or in other words, A over B is equal to K over N for some N, for some K. Okay, so it's in our identified group here. Why don't we give this thing a name? Let me call it S for subgroup sub N. So H is contained in S sub N, and of course, since that has the right number of elements, it has to be the whole thing by counting. Okay. Anyone have any comments or thoughts? Do this differently or add more or less detail? All right, then let's go back to the exam and see which one to do next. So that's two down. And recall that four should be passing. Okay, so we dealt with five and we dealt with two. What next?
Three, maybe?
All right, let's try three. Okay, so just looking at it, so this is a yes, no, right? Of course, one has a different approach than the other. Do we already know what the answer should be, or do we start to work that out? Is it going to be yes or no? Okay, so there are two possibilities, and so either we need to find a counterexample so we can throw our various best examples at that, or we need to have an approach. So let's see, so did someone have an approach to trying to show that these two things are isomorphic? So how do we show things are isomorphic almost always?
Write down an injective R-module homomorphism?
Right. We actually write down a map. That's almost always the way to do it. It's really hard to show things are isomorphic without a map by finding a map. Okay, so that would, if we were going to try to show it was true, then that's what we would do. And does anyone see a map between these two things?
Take F to F evaluated at 1.
Okay, that sounds good. So so we can take this this map from HOM RM to M by taking F to F at 1. Yeah, and we have a unital ring, so that makes sense, right? Okay, so there we have a candidate map. So if that's to work, then we just have to check that it constitutes an R-module isomorphism, left R-module isomorphism. So what things would we have to check to see that that's a left R-module isomorphism? So which things have to be preserved to make it just a left R module map to begin with?
Addition of module elements and multiplication by R.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, and so we just have to check those. So let's see, so how does that to check? So we have to check that F plus G goes to F plus G at 1, which is the same as F at 1 plus G at 1, which is true. And we multiply by R, so R times F evaluated at 1 should be the same as R times F evaluated at 1, and that's also true, right? Now, technically, I probably could have said a little bit more. For example, I could have explicitly written out what the left R module structure is on that HOM, right? So that would be something that I could have done. Depending on how detailed I wanted to be. So I could write out the R module structure on this HOM. Okay. Which would, of course, entail exactly these things. We have to say what it means to add two maps and what it means to multiply them by R. Right. So you can either write that out or you could assume it. Right. Okay, so that gives us that it's an R module homomorphism. And what it remains to be done.
Injectivity.
Okay, so
it is injective because the only way to send 1 to 0 is to send everything to 0.
Okay, injective since if F goes to 0, then F of 1 is equal to 0, so F of R is equal to F of 1 times R is equal to 0 times F of R is equal to 0. Right, so we just have the 0 map. So that's injective. It does ask for an isomorphism. Is there some way that I can avoid showing that having to show that it's also surjective, or do I still have to do that? I feel like I still have to show that it's surjective. When there are several ways to do that.
I mean, one way, I guess, is to just, like, given an arbitrary M in M, like, exhibit a map that does what you want.
Yeah, that would be certainly sufficient. Surjective, so if you take little M in M, then define, as you say, some explicit map. So F sub little M of R, and what would be the explicit map?
Just RM.
Yeah, so R, M. Okay, and so there we've defined something, and I guess the only thing we have to check is that that is in fact an R module homomorphism. Because it's pretty obvious that it is taken to little m. I guess we should write that down, but it's pretty clear, right? So check FM is in hom R. RM, and check that we should have given this thing a name. It's really horrible not to give names. Let me call this phi. Check phi of F is equal to FM is equal to M. Right. And those are both easy checks. What I would do in writing this up is I would say, here are the things I would have to check. They're both easy checks, and then I would stop. That's what I would do. So make it clear that the reader knows that you know what you have to check, and also that there's nothing tricky there. Okay, any comments or thoughts about this one? Okay, so that's three down. What might be the next one to approach? Well, we have three left. We could also eliminate. Is there one that looks just too frightening to be the next one to do?
Sex.
All right. Okay.
At least for me, that one looks very scary to me.
Okay. All right. So that only is 1 and 4. So we got to launch ourselves into one of those. Which one looks better?
Personally, I feel like I could squeeze more points out of number one than number four, I think.
All right. Well, let's try
because
number
one. I know what I need to do for number four, and I know that it's something that I need to study again.
Okay. All right. All right. So let's try one, and then we can just say a little bit about four and six just to see just comments. But yeah, this will be the fourth one then. Okay. So let's see. And I've kind of messed up all the space, so. Maybe I'll just erase and then try it here. So, yeah. Okay. So number one. So, cyclic loop of order four. All right. So, which representations? So, what do we know about representations? First of all, this is a group you should be very familiar with. It comes up a lot, right? So, C4. Along with, say, the dihedral group of order 8 are very common and good ones to get used to. All right, and let's see, we're asked about its representation theory. So do we know just offhand what the representations of C4 are, the irreducible representations?
Since it's abelian, does that mean that there's four one-dimensional representations?
It does, but you should add one more adjective. What kind of representations?
Oh, irreducible.
Irreducible, one more. What field?
Complex.
Complex, right. And that is the key here, is that we're asked for real. So that's a good point, and it's a good thing to know, is that over C, there are four one-dimensional irreducible representations. Isomorphism, and you can write out the diagram, the table if you like. Right. Okay. So, but this is R, and so what happens to those irreducible representations over R? Oops. R. So if you don't know the answer immediately, one thing to do is to go write the table, right? So if we just drew the table, right? So they're a squared, a cubed, and we can just write down the character table. Does anyone know the rest of it? So this much we have already determined, right?
One, negative one, one, negative one.
Uh-huh. And the two that are not real.
One I, negative one, negative I.
Correct.
And then whatever the product of the second and third rows is.
Exactly.
So negative I, negative one, I.
Exactly so. And so what we've observed, these have real coefficients, so those are real representations, and this is not, right? Okay, so if I wanted to build, say, the character of the irreducible, so we've got these two irreducibles over R that are also irreducible over C, and then we're going to, and then these two are reducible, are irreducibles over C, but they're not real representations, but if I take their sum, then it is, right? So there are two one-dimensional and one two-dimensional real irreducible representation. And that's good just to know, because that one comes up a lot. Okay. All right, and we're trying to find an example of a real representation that's irreducible, but such that when we tensor it over R, it becomes reducible. Okay, so what does that tell us about the dimension?
It has to be greater than one.
Exactly, that is the key point. So if our module were one dimensional,
then the tensor would also have would also be one dimensional, but then every one dimensional representation is irreducible.
Exactly. Okay. So the answer is whatever two-dimensional representation we have that's irreducible, right? And also, is it clear that the tensor product of this one with itself cannot be irreducible? Well, at least if we assume that I've completely listed all of the irreducibles over R.
Yes, because it would be a four-dimensional representation.
Exactly.
And yeah, so it would have to be reducible.
Right. Okay, so that's essentially the answer, but now we can try to be more or less explicit about what it means to give a real representation of M. Right. So, for example, we could, what would be a very explicit way to give a two-dimensional representation of the cyclic group?
We could go looking for four matrices that map EA, A squared, A cubed.
That's right. We could definitely do that. And that's probably the easiest thing to do. So explicitly, and actually since our group has just one generator, it's enough to find one matrix and then the rest are just the powers of it. Okay, so I can take a row of my generator, G. Okay, and so, and does anyone know how to find such a 2x2 matrix? So I would just do it geometrically. So the geometry is that I'm just going to rotate my two space.
Zero, one, negative one, zero.
Exactly. Okay. And to check that that's a representation, what needs to be done? So my group G is the group generated by this little g, and its only relation is that g to the fourth is the identity.
So we need to make sure that it has order four.
That's right. That's all we need to do. We have to check that row g to the fourth is equal to the identity matrix.
Should we also check that row squared does not equal the identity?
No, it would still be a representation.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. It would be one induced from the map to Z2, but it would still be a representation. Okay, very good. And right, so we found a two-dimensional representation of our group, which we believe is irreducible. And we've shown down here that if we found any such thing, then it should be it should satisfy the requirements that we want. And so what will we have to do to check that this is actually irreducible?
Check to make sure there are no non-zero invariant subspaces.
That's right. And since it's only two-dimensional, what does that amount to? So if I had a non-trivial invariant subspace, since the whole thing is only two-dimensional, it would have to be one-dimensional, right? So that would mean an eigenvector. We just have to check that it has no real eigenvectors. Okay. And since its eigenvalues are plus or minus I, it does not. Oh, check. No real eigenvectors that rho of G has. Sorry, this is a bit of a mess. But yeah, rho of G has no real eigenvectors. But the eigenvalues are plus or minus I. Okay, so we've done it. We've built something. We figured out what it ought to be here. Then we said, okay, well, since I know what it should be, I can just do it, all right? And we explicitly wrote down what the representation was. Check there's a representation. Check that it was irreducible. Okay, any questions about that? So that's a pretty thorough coverage of that one. Okay, and once again, it's an example that comes up a lot, and it's a good one just to have in the back of your mind that the complex and real ones behave a little bit differently, and here's an example of how. Okay, any other thoughts or comments about this one? Okay, so that's four. And so I didn't want to do as much detail on the last two because we don't really need to do them, but did anyone want to say or ask anything about the two that we didn't do? So let's see, that was this one, and what was the other one? This one, 4 and 6.
For 6, do you look at, what's the series that you look at?
Yeah, so for nilpotent, you can, there are various things you could look at. So you could look for something that's in the commutator of G with itself, and then the commutator of that with G again. You could, that's a perfectly good one. That one has to terminate if the thing is nilpotent. That one works pretty well here. So you can find something that's in the commutator, and then you can find something that's in the next one, and then inductively you can kind of build an example so that that never becomes trivial. That's probably that's one way to approach this. Another way is that if it is nilpotent, then it has a center. So you can try to ask whether it has a center. Okay, other comments or questions about that one?
But if it has a trivial center, then we can say for sure that it is not nilpotent.
Yes, right.
If it has a non-trivial center, then that's not necessarily enough for us to include anything, right?
That's right. What you can do is quotient out by it and then start working.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is this one just as... manual labor intensive as it seems like it is?
I think so. Okay. It's not actually too bad. There is a pretty fast pattern you get, but in any case, yeah. The way that I would do it is kind of direct computation with words.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it turns out that the words that are involved are just powers of y, and it's a fairly simple sequence of words that turn out to be the right answer, but yeah, that's what I would do. And I could even write it out so you could compute.
Can't you? So you can always move a y to the left.
Yeah.
To increase the power by 20.
That's right.
So you get all the lefts on, or all the y's as the left.
That's right. So in other words, there's a canonical form for all the words, which makes it pretty easy to identify whether elements are trivial and whatnot, which is really helpful in a group. That's right. So you have this canonical form. But you can also compute, for example, that if you take the commutator of x and y, like you said, you can do this, flip it around, add a 20 and get this in the form, and it's going to be just a power of y. So that's something in the commutator. And then you can keep going and compute the commutator here. And get that, again, you just flip it around and get this factor of 20, and it's y to the 20 squared. And now the pattern is relatively clear, and you can just keep going and get that y to the 20 to the k is in this this kth commutator, and so it's not trivial. That's kind of how it works.
Is this one of those tests where they like to ask questions with the year number, where I should go and study all the properties of the number 2020 and 2021?
This is not a Putnam, but it's no. That's actually kind of rare. Yeah. And this wasn't even the year, right? This was some other number. This was last year. This was 2019. All right. Any other thoughts or questions about this one? Okay, so let's go to the next exam then.
Professor, did we do one of the, I don't know, I think we missed one of the questions from the last one.
We did miss it, because we don't need to do all of them. We only need to do four.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay.
But if you want that, we can comment on that one. But my intention is not to do in any detail of the hard ones, just to get four out of the way. But I'm happy to make comments about that last one if you had questions about it.
I think I have no idea how to do it, and I would like to know it. But after your plans, of course, like I.
Yeah, no, we can just briefly. It turns out not to be that bad, actually. So number four here, we didn't say anything about, right? Okay, so what if we had one-by-one matrices? Then could you answer this question?
Yeah, it's prime Z, or a prime N.
Product.
Oh, product.
So let's just do one example. Oh, well,
It's all of them, isn't it?
No. So let's just try a couple. So Z mod 2Z, of course, that's a field, right? That's right. That's prime. Z mod 3, of course, is also. But what about Z mod 4Z? That one's not a field, right? And it's not a product of fields.
Oh.
Right? Because it's got the zero divisor, but it's not a product of rings. What about Z mod 6Z? Right, so six factors and so by the Chinese remainder theorem or the classification, however you want to view it, that's F2 cross F3.
So it would be products of distinct primes.
That's right. So that's the correct answer. So products of distinct primes is the answer. So it's square free. Right. So this is the matrices of size 1x1. Okay. But now the fundamental observation that makes this problem not as bad as it looks is that if I have a matrix ring over a product of fields like this, you can just work out that this is isomorphic to just the product of matrix rings. They just don't see each other, the different primes.
Okay, thank you so much, Professor.
Mm-hmm. Right. Other comments or questions about that one? All right, so then let's go to the next exam and look for the easy ones here. And yeah, I'll give you a couple minutes to read it again. It's been a week and a half since we've looked at this one. Okay, let's see. So anyone spot one that should be gotten out of the way?
Number two,
all right. Okay, and what would be the approach to this one? So I guess you have to do two things. You have to show there's a representation of order at least two, and that there isn't a representation of order more than two, and then we would be done. Right?
We could count how many conjugacy classes there are and then use our nice formula.
Yes, we can. But and that simplifies quite a bit in this case. Do people see why? So what's our formula going to say about three-dimensional representations?
There aren't any.
Right, because 9 is already bigger than 8, right? So since the order of the group is less than 3 squared, only 1 and 2 dimensions are possible. Right, so our formula gives us that without much work. You don't have to go through making things equal. Okay, and then, so we're almost done. All we have to do is show that they're not all one-dimensional. So what would that mean?
There are 8 conjugacy classes.
Right, and what's another way to say that they're all one-dimensional and that they're the same number of conjugacy classes as elements in your group?
The group is abelian.
Correct. So not all one-dimensional if G is not abelian. Okay. So that's the second observation. And so then all we have to do is argue that G is not abelian. And can we do that?
Yes, it is the quaternions.
That's right. So you could either sort of note that the quaternions are not abelian.
Oh, so it says that in the group. So I don't know if that would, that might be cheating. I think if you just do two of them, IJ, JI, there's a combo.
Yeah, you could compute because you're given the presentation here, right? So in theory, you should be able to compute. And since you know it's the quaternions, you know what to compute, right? You know that IJ is different from JI, right? So you just have to find a way to get that fact from this presentation.
What's the general statement of the fact that you have starred that if the order of the group is less than?
So the statement here is that the sum of the dimensions of the irreducible representations squared is equal to the order of the group. That's the statement. And this is a corollary of it. Since the order of G is less than 3 squared itself, you can't have anything of order 3 or bigger. Does that answer your question?
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. Thanks.
Okay. Okay, so yeah, so then we just have to make some explicit argument that futzing around with the generators to get that this is not an abelian group. Right, and that could be a little bit messy, but does anyone want to say more about that, or is that something you think you can just do?
Can you think of them in terms of permutations?
You could do that.
I don't remember what ones work. But.
Oh, what? The, so yeah, so it should be that ij is equal to k and ji is equal to minus k is what should be happening. Right. So they should be. None of these generators should commute with each other. They should all introduce a sign when you flip them. That's what they should all look like. Okay, and so then you can futz around with this, and you can use the fact that your group is non-trivial also and has 8 elements to get explicit names for the elements, if you wish. Right, so then the names, I'll just leave it there. Okay, I don't want to say anything more about this one, or should we look for another one? Okay. All right, so we dealt with two. So which other ones look tractable here?
Number 3.
All right. Got all these parts. So think about these parts while I translate it onto this other board here. Okay, so let me put this on the other board. All right, so how hard is this? And so what's the degree here?
4.
Right. What kind of extension is this, by the way? This is a type of extension that comes up a lot.
Cyclotomic?
Exactly. And in terms of C, we have these four extra roots that are added. Right. Okay, very good. So it's degree 4. And how do I find a basis?
One, eta, eta squared, eta cubed, where eta is a primitive fifth root of unity.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so then right, so that's A. B.
So cyclotomic extensions are gawa, which means that the degree of the extension is equal to the order of the group of homomorphisms.
Okay. And there are two groups of that order. How do we know which one it is? So we have Z4 or Z2 cross Z2, right? So this is, so we just have to eliminate one of those and then we're done.
If we can find one element in the group of automorphisms that's of order 2, then that combined with this first fact is enough. Or sorry, of order 4.
4, right, exactly right. So we just need to find one. And actually, since C asks us to explicitly give it in terms of a basis, we're going to have to find one anyway, right? So we need to find one anyway. So we might as well find an element of this automorphism group. Okay, so how is this automorphism group going to act on these complex roots here? Or more explicitly, the thing to remember is that it does act on those complex roots, right? On the 4 possible complex roots.
It's going to permute them, but the permutation is going to be uniquely determined by where it sends eta.
That's so, right.
Yeah.
That's right. So let's just choose one. So where should we take it?
Eta squared.
All right. So if we take it to eta squared, so let's so explicitly construct an automorphism. Phi, mapping Q adjoin, it's supposed to be zeta, we're not very good at drawing it, to zeta, taking a zeta to its square, and then there's these other ones, and we just need to figure out where they go, right? So where is the square going to go? So this needs to be a field automorphism, right?
Eta to the 4.
That's right, because it just has to do that. And then what about the cubed one?
Ada.
Yep.
No.
Nope.
Yeah. No. What?
Oh, sorry. Yes. Sorry. Oh, you're right. You're right. I was thinking of the wrong one. You're right. You're right. And then the fourth.
Ada cubed.
Yeah, of course it's got to permute, so there's no choice. That's right. So yeah. So if I draw it in my little picture, I get this cycle, right, of length four, and so it's got the right order. And so we have eliminated this group, and we have the isomorphism type of our group. Okay, and let's see. So then C, describe the action on the basis. So I didn't actually write down a basis. I wrote down my list of roots. So when I go back to the basis, so what would it mean to describe the action? Well, one way would be to just write down a matrix. Okay, so let's just do that. So a matrix. Okay, so so this automorphism that we have here, phi. So phi is given by, and I'm going to take the basis that we started with there above. Okay, and so in that basis, what is the matrix?
One goes to one.
That's right, so that one's easy. Oh, sorry.
And Ada goes to Ada squared, so that one's also straightforward.
That's right, except I think I put my zeros in the wrong place, but yeah, okay. Right? Ada just goes to Ada squared. Okay, and Ada squared.
Ada cubed goes to Ada, so 0, 1, 0, 0.
Okay, so that was easy.
And then it's the last one that I have to see if I remember how to rewrite Ada fourth in terms of these other elements.
That's right. Okay, so that's all we have to do. So a squared one goes to the fourth, and how do we rewrite it in terms of our basis? So the way that I remember it is, I know that the sum of all the roots is easy to remember. Because right, they're symmetrically arranged around the circle, so when I add all five of those, I get zero.
So that should just be a column of all negative ones, right?
That sounds right, yeah. So minus one, minus one, minus one, minus one.
That's true for any cyclotomic extension where the sum of all of the roots is zero?
Yeah, if you include one as a root, yeah. All the roots, yeah. Just by symmetry. Makes it easy to remember. Okay, so there's our matrix, and all right. Okay, and we still haven't done my favorite thing whenever we're doing these field theory problems, right? So it's just to draw all the fields that are around. So we've got our Q here, right? And then there's the field we've been dealing with mostly, which is where we extend it with this zeta here, and that was a degree four extension. But from the fundamental theorem of Galois theory, what other extensions have to be there? So do you remember what the bijection is between intermediate extensions?
Yeah, it has to be an extension of degree two.
That's right. And there's how many extensions actually are there in between these two?
Just one.
There's just one, right? Because there's only one subgroup to this particular group. Had it been Z2 cross Z2, there would have been three of them, right? Because there are three subgroups in intermediate there. But here there's just one subgroup, and so that's the one that lives in there. And as you say, it's got to be degree two. So there's our intermediate field. Let me call it F. Right, and it's got to be some degree two thing. And it says to describe it. Yeah, maybe. Can we find it? So it's degree two. Can we find a basis for it? over Q. Right, it's just a two-dimensional vector space. We know one is one of the basis elements, so we just need one more element.
Just the square of the root of unity.
Well, let's try it. So if we take the square of the root of unity and apply our automorphism is supposed to be twice the automorphism that we just gave, right? So if we do it twice, then we end up with the cube. So that's not going to work. So what element of this field can we take that when we apply this automorphism twice, so when we apply phi squared, it comes back to some linear combination, or just itself even. Right, so this square, after you apply it twice, is going to land here in the cube, right?
I think the sum, maybe, of two of the...
Yeah, which two would do it?
The squared and the cubed.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Or now, the other pair.
Or the other pair, either one, right. In fact, they're linearly dependent on each other, right. So that's right, so that's going to work. So we can just take zeta squared plus zeta cubed, and that will be our intermediate field. Agreed to extension, and as you can see, it's invariant under this phi squared, and phi squared is the automorphism in question, because we've listed all of them, because there are only four, and they're generated by this phi that we wrote down here. So I believe that completes the problem. And any thoughts or questions about this one? All right. Okay, so let's see. So where does that leave us? So we've got... we did 2 here. And we did 3. Okay, so do others look tractable?
I really think that 6 is not so bad, even though it's a lot of words, but I'm afraid that once I start, I might find that it's actually a quagmire.
Okay, well, for 6, why don't we maybe just talk through what it would require without actually doing it? Let's just see which things would have to be checked so that we can see just how big a project it would be to do number 6, okay? So that would be one approach. All right, well, I'll try to write around the margins here. Actually, I think I can shrink it. Okay, now I have bigger margins. All right, so... right, so for 6... is this too small to be legible, or people can still read it?
It's more the contrast in the colors that makes it a little harder to read.
Ah, okay. All right. Well, okay. Well, I'll try to write on the white then. Maybe that's easier.
So I think that S is going to be like a rectangle of points on the integer lattice.
Okay, yeah, so it's certainly worth trying to figure out what it is, right? So S itself, so first of all, we're in this thing here, the integer lattice, and we're looking at the place where they're all non-negative, right? That's the first thing it said. S is sitting inside of there somehow, right? That's the first thing it says here. And the complement satisfies whenever I have something in here that's not in it. So this IJ, then when I add one to it or in either direction, then it's also not in it. So that means that if this dot's not there, then none of these are there. Okay, but there may be another one that's not there. Maybe this one's not there, so none of these are there. And then maybe this one over here is not there, so none of those are there. So my interpretation is that that is what S looks like.
Okay, but the third dot along the left-hand column, the third one from the bottom,
uh-huh.
That one can't possibly be there either, because if that one was there... Oh, well, no, never mind.
Yeah, so my interpretation is this blue thing is what S looks like, and the red thing is what S complement looks like. Like that. Okay, so then we're going to get a vector space that's generated by these things. These dots, I guess I should make them blue. These blue dots are going to be our basis. And I think it can keep, I think it could be infinite like the one I've drawn. Like that, okay? Basis. And the variables act in the obvious way. Okay, so what would be the things that would be required? If we wanted to check that this actually gives an R module, what would be required?
Addition of the module elements and multiplication by R. But we can just check this on the basis elements.
Okay.
Right? And if it works on the base elements, then it should expand linearly to work on everything?
Yes, particularly, well, of course, when you add them, you won't end up with the basis element, but you'll end up with a linear combination of bases, which is fine, right? So, that's right. Yes, so you're right. It's enough to, let's see, so, So we were already told it was a K vector space, right? So how much of that does it get rid of for us?
Addition.
Yeah, we don't have to check this one at all, right? So we're just left with checking this multiplication by elements. And as you say, then it's sufficient to check it on the basis elements. Okay, so that's what we had to do for A. And then for B, we're supposed to describe an isomorphism between the tensor product and the intersection using the universal property of tensors, define it. So there's several things here we're supposed to describe, we're supposed to define, and we're supposed to prove that these maps are inverses. Oh yeah, okay, right. So to do that, do we remember which direction and how, what it means to get to use the universal property of tensor products? So we've got our object here. Yep.
If we can write down a R bilinear map from the direct product of MS and MT.
Exactly.
Into M of the intersection of S and T, then that extends uniquely to a map from the tensor product into the module over the intersection.
Exactly right. So then we get this unique extension, and that's going to give us one of the two directions, right? So that's the map that we want to build using the universal property. So I guess I should use another color for, I try to use four colors for universal properties. So this green map is the one that we need to build, right? So that's what you have to do. You have to write down a map, and it's going to be something where you have a product. it's got to be bilinear, so it's going to be enough to define it on a basis element across a basis element, right? And then extend by bilinearity. So you'll have to define it on something that looks like two points here in the lattice.
I think there's kind of a canonical map here that it's like if both P and Q are in the intersection, then it's going to go to P times Q. If either of them are not, then it's going to go to zero. That's what my intuition is. And so I guess then I would just have to
check that that works. That's right. Yeah. So you want to do something like P plus Q if that's in the intersection and zero otherwise. Yeah, so that's a very reasonable guess. And since it's it defines a bilinear map, it will map, it will give us a map on the tensor products, and then you just want to argue that, and then it says define an inverse map explicitly, right? So then you're gonna have to go the other way and actually build a map going backward, but this will guide you because you have already understood that map. So does that sort of give a feel for what has to be checked?
Yeah, this question was, I kind of liked this question because it felt very Simon Says-y. Like I just had to do what the question told me to do.
That's right. It's like that. It's yeah. So it has that's a big advantage, particularly if you're getting stuck and you can't figure out what to do. This is one where you just kind of do crawl your nose and you just have to keep going and make sure you've done everything. There's a bunch of steps, so you just have to make sure you've done them all. And nothing really terribly complicated happens along the way. You just have to keep going and do it. Yeah. Okay, so any other thoughts or comments about this one? All right. Okay, let's see. So we've dealt with two here. We dealt with three. We just dealt with six. That's three. And four is usually a passing. So if you get good answers for them. So we need one more.
Five, maybe.
All right, so let's try five. So it's got two parts, and the first one is a true false. So is that one true or false, that if any finite commutative ring with unit is a product of fields? So what's our reservoir of examples? How do we get examples of finite rings?
Can we just consider Z mod 4Z again?
Yeah, that's a very good example. As we did recently. Exactly, that's a very good example to use, and it's certainly the sort of thing you should be thinking about. And as, of course, you're pointing out, that one fails to be a product of fields. Right. Okay, great. So that's A. B. So which theorem is this one going to be? So there's a little bit of a trick. So what's another way to write this Z adjoin I?
Sorry, what's the proof that Z mod 4Z is not a product of fields?
Yeah, okay, that's a good question. So first of all, I claim that it's not a non-trivial product. So first, product of fields. So it's not a field because it has... a zero divisor. I kind of get the code right. Right. Okay. So one, it's not a field. Since two times two is zero. Right. Two, it's not a non-trivial product. Okay, and let's see, so what's the easiest way to prove that?
If it were a product, you'd have to have two sub rings, I guess, of order two.
Correct.
In order for the product to be non-trivial, and we know that Z mod 4Z is not isomorphic to Z2 squared.
That's a very good point. So, or another way to say exactly what you said is that there would have to be at least two sub rings, the two sum ends, but here there's actually only one sub ring, right? And so there's only... One non-trivial subring. Since only one element doesn't generate the whole ring. The entire ring, so only the set 0 and 2 is a non-trivial subring. Okay. And if it were a product, then each of the two sum ends would have to give distinct subrings. Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right, so we've got that it's, so that's A. Any other thoughts about A? Okay, let me erase because there's not much space here. So then B. Okay, so if we're going to approach B. So that's where I was before. So if we look at this Z adjoin I, is there another way to think about Z adjoin I that might make this simpler to work with?
Easier if you did a polynomial.
Yeah, definitely. So Z adjoin I can think of as a polynomial ring, and how is that related to a polynomial ring?
When you mod out by x squared plus one.
Correct. So that's right. So that's the way to say it. So in other words, I can take this this ring that we're interested in. Let me call it R, so there's a name. So I can take R and rewrite it as a Z adjoin two variables. Just one variable X, and then take a quotient by the sum of these two ideals. So the ideal 41 and X squared plus one. Right. So that's just another way to rewrite R. Which gives us a little bit more leeway in how to work with it. Does that make sense to everyone? Okay, so once it's written that way, then what theorem would I use to get its decomposition? Let me write it more cleanly up here. Yeah, so the trick with these is usually to switch the order in which you do things and it still makes sense. So if I, instead of quotienting by the polynomial x squared plus 1, I quotient by the 41, what do I get?
Do you just do, you quotient the coefficients?
That's right. So I'm gonna end up with a field and a polynomial ring over a field. And what kind of ring is a polynomial ring over a field? That's a PID, right? So then we can use our classification theorem for modules over a PID. Okay, and so if we're gonna try to decompose, as we're asked, a quotient of a polynomial ring over a field into a product, what do I need to do?
Decompose the polynomial.
That's right. So I need to factor this polynomial. And actually, can anyone see right offhand whether this polynomial is going to factor? Let me rewrite it because it's hard to read while someone answers that. So what I would be thinking about is the multiplicative ring of my field F41. So what is the multiplicative group, rather, of the field F41?
This isn't an answer to that question, but I think x squared plus 1 factors into x minus 11 and x plus 11 over
that sounds right.
F41.
Okay. Okay, I didn't check, but it's very plausible. This is the right roots. And what's the What's the main point about those two roots?
That are different, so we can use a training frame under term.
Exactly, the fact that they're different. So then we get F41 join X mod the first one cross F41 join X mod the second one, and these quotients, at least as far as the ring structure goes, are just naming the X. So this is then so that we're done. So then this is just isomorphic to a product of F41 with itself. Okay, is everyone happy with that? Very good. Okay. Any other thoughts? Okay, actually, maybe I will just, because I do have another way that I like to think about this. So we've got that one done. Here's another way to think about the fact that it should have had this kind of decomposition. Do people remember what the multiplicative group of any finite field is?
Well, it's cyclic. That's all I know.
That's right. It's always cyclic, and it's got everything except the zero in it, right? So it's cyclic of order one less than your prime p. Right. So the multiplicative group is this isomorphic to C40, okay? And minus one squared is one, right? So if I take a generator of my cyclic group A here, then and one is gonna be A to the zero, of course, because it's one. But minus one is going to be A to the 20th, right? Because when you square it, you get one. And there's only one thing in the cyclic group that does that. Okay, so how do I know that the minus one has two square roots? Is that clear? So if I take A to the 10th here and I square it, I'm going to get minus 1. Or similarly, if I take A to the minus 10 or A to the 30th here, I'm going to get minus 1. So those are my two roots. Okay, so I can just see from the fact that P minus 1 is divisible by 4, that minus 1 is going to have two square roots. Or I could compute it, as you did. Okay. All right, any other thoughts about this one? Okay. So I believe that does it. So yeah, so I think we didn't do number one, we did number two, we did number three, did number, I forget if we did that one, but we did number five and six, we didn't do four. So we just didn't do one and four. I don't want to do any details on those. Any comments briefly about one and four, about how you might approach them or whether they look particularly difficult for some reason?
So I didn't understand. Did you already solve the problem one?
Nope. Four we did not do, and I do not think we need to because we have solved four problems and that is sufficient to pass the exam.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I think we also looked at number one the other day.
Yeah, we did. How far did we get though?
We just proved part A.
That's right. We did A, which isn't really too bad. Yeah. is a bit more work.
That's just a CELO.
Yeah, it's a CELO type thing, but it turns out that there are lots of choices.
Oh.
Yeah. And so it turns out to be some work. And this also, it comes from something. So this subgroup has a name. It's a Borel subgroup. And it looks like 111 star, star, star. And that has the right order, right? Because there are three choices for each of those upper triangular ones. And so that's order 27. So that's what our CELO subgroup looks like, is it's the Borel subgroup. And then there's kind of a theory of how to understand what all the conjugates are of a Borel subgroup. And that, I think, is actually the easiest way to get at this one. So it turns out to actually be, I think, fairly challenging to do B, particularly if you don't recognize that this is a Borel subgroup of a Lie group of finite type. Finite group of Lie type. Okay, and four, I think we also talked about a little bit back when we were doing tensor products. Actually, I think four is not that bad, but anyway, there it is. Okay, any other thoughts or comments about this exam before trying four problems on another one? Okay, so let's move on. Okay, I just spend a minute or two reminding yourself again, we looked at this one last week. Okay, maybe another 30 seconds and then we'll try to decide which ones to try first. All right, so any thoughts about a good one to get started with?
I think five is fairly easy.
All right. And what would be the approach there?
The freshman dream idea of a characteristic P field, or at least I'm trying to think of if you had... I don't know. Maybe not.
Okay. Actually, five. Does anyone know five?
Yeah.
Okay. What's the answer?
We can consider the rational functions over FP.
Uh-huh. And then what would be a good polynomial?
We can consider y to the pth power minus an element who is not a power.
like x?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry, that was what I was trying to describe as well.
Okay, good. That's the right answer. Okay, that's the right answer. If you don't know that that's the answer, I think it's kind of hard because you have to use a field that like this. But if you know that answer, then you just kind of write it down and like that. Right. Okay, and let's see, someone's pointing out that with one, once one knows the trick, then that one is also not too bad. Okay, so let's see, so we did five, and okay, and so with one, then what happens? So is that one, one can just kind of start going? What would you do to find the splitting field for a cubic? So what's the first thing to do?
Check if the polynomial is irreducible.
Yep, and if with a cubic, how do we do that?
Checking if it has roots.
Exactly. Check for irreducible by looking for roots. Since it's cubic.
When can you take the derivative and it tells you something?
Yeah, actually, that's the one we just did. That's this one here. If we take the derivative of that, which is a little bit confusing, but what is the derivative of this one? Okay, give me, with respect to y. Y is the thing that you're taking the derivative.
Yeah, the py, p to the minus one.
Yeah, so it's going to be p to the minus one. And what is p in this field, in this ring?
Zero,
right? So this is zero. And so that's what you're looking for to get examples for number five. You're looking for something whose derivative is zero. If it's inseparable, the derivative will be non-zero. That's where you do that, right? Okay, all right, so let's see, we were, so first thing you look for roots, and if you don't find any roots, then what happens? All right, so then we have our original field, and we get some extension, right? Okay, and how do we tell if that's splitting? So might we be done at this point? I think there are two possibilities now. Right, so this is a degree three extension. And what are the possibilities for the order of the splitting fields extension?
It's three or less, or three, yeah.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear what the first thing said. So three is one and the other? Okay, so we've added a root. Our polynomial now has one root. We can split that off. And there are two things that could happen. Either it factors into three linear terms, or it just factors into a linear and a quadratic. And in that second case, what do we have to do? Then we have to extend again and get a degree two extension of this. Okay, so you end up adding two things to your thing. So those are the two possibilities. That's always how you do it with splitting fields. You add one and see how much it splits, and then add another and keep going. And the rule is that the most you can get to is n factorial, because they keep getting smaller. Okay. So are people following this? Should we do this one in more detail, or is it done? Clear.
So I don't understand.
Okay.
So which turns out to be the splitting field of the polynomial?
I haven't worked it out yet. I'm just saying what the chances are. But let's just try it. Let's
just do this one.
So it's what is it? X cubed plus X plus one. All right. So let's just do that one. Let me switch boards where I have more space and just work it out. So okay, so we're over, so we have x cubed plus x plus 1 in F5 adjoint x, and we want the splitting field, right? Okay, so step one, look for roots. Did anyone already do that? So 0 is not a root, 1 is not a root. Minus 1 is not a root. 2 is not a root. And minus 2 is not a root. Okay, so no roots. So we know that so 2 you consider the field F5 adjoint X mod X cubed plus X plus 1. All right, we call that F, and so we have F over F5. And this has this is an extension of order 3. Okay, so this is what we've got. And the question is that the splitting field? F is a trouble name because it looks too similar to the other one. We call it K. Okay, so So now the discussion is how does this factor, all right? So so we check for factorization. Of this polynomial, y cubed plus y plus 1 in k adjoint y, right? So that's what we want to do, right? And we can do that. So we know that x is a root because that's how we built it, right? So we know that we have this y cubed plus y plus 1 is equal to x minus y times something, right? So we just, y minus x is the right way to write it. So they are equivalent. Y minus x times something, right? And so we just have to factor, right? So we just do long division. And so what do we need? So we need y squared. Okay, so that gives us y squared minus y squared x, so plus yx. Okay, and so then we have a minus let's see, so finish my long division here. Yeah. Okay, I guess it's with x squared plus 1. Yeah, okay, so that's what I get when I divide, right? Just doing long division. Okay, and then I just check this for roots. So check this quadratic here for roots. Okay. Right, so I need some polynomial in x that's a root for this. And there are various ways that I can do it. I can, for example, choose a basis here. Since x cubed is equal to something, I don't need any x cubed. So I can check for roots of the form a plus bx plus cx squared. Right. So is that clear? So then, I just have to multiply this out. So I just compute. So y squared is equal to a squared plus b squared x squared plus c squared x to the fourth plus 2ab x plus 2ac x squared plus 2bc x cubed, right? And then I have a yx. So that's ax plus bx squared plus cx cubed. And then I have an x squared plus 1. Now I can replace the x squareds with minus x minus x to the cubed by minus x minus 1. And so then this simplifies. So y squared is a squared plus b squared x squared, so that stays the same. And then this c squared x times minus x minus 1, plus the other terms, plus 2ab x plus 2ac x squared plus 2bc minus x minus 1, and the yx is equal to ax plus bx squared plus c times minus x minus 1. Okay, so I just get, I can just explicitly work out what these things are. And so then if this is a root, I have y squared plus yx plus x squared plus 1 is equal to. Okay, and then I can collect terms. So let's see, if I take the x squared terms, I end up with something times x squared, something times x, and then some constant, right? And so my x squared terms, let's see, so I end up with a minus c squared and a plus 2ac. Plus b squared plus 1, plus a b. So one more term. Okay, and then my x's, I end up with a from the y squared, I have a minus c squared and plus 2ab minus 2bc plus a minus c. All right, and then for my constant term, I have a, let's see, x squared minus 2bc. And minus c and a plus one. Okay. So then I just have to solve for a, b, and c in f5 that satisfy for which those three are zero. Okay. Right, so that would be the question. And again, it's a finite check. And so you can just start eliminating. So for example, this thing being zero, so one is one minus c minus 2bc is equal to zero, tells me that, let's see, that c is equal to one over one plus 2b. Okay, so then I can substitute something in for C. Okay, and then I'll get the equations involving just A and B, and I can solve for that. Okay, so I'm not sure if this is helpful or not. Is it clear that this is something you can just solve for? Nope. Okay. So, yeah, all right. So I'm not quite sure what to say. You can just check whether this has roots. Okay, so let's try a different problem. Okay, yeah, so so let's see, so so number one is a Galois theory problem. All right. So what would be another one that looks tractable? All right, number two. Okay, so how would we approach two? Right, that one follows from the definition. right? If we have a people remember that? We talked about this one before. If we have a nilpotent group, then we have the trivial group contained in some G1, contained in et cetera. And in particular, we need this to be contained in the center. Right, the first non-trivial one to be contained in the center. So if the center is trivial, then you're done. Okay, so that one's short. All right, so let's see, so we've got two. And we got five here. All right, we got number four. So how many elements will there be in our bases?
Four.
Right. So basis has four elements. Okay, and are they easy to write out?
Yeah, just when an I tensor all the combinations.
Exactly. Okay. Right, so there's our basis. So that part was straightforward. And then we just have to work out the product of a pair. I guess there are only 16 pairs, and so you have a little table, and some of them will be easier. None of them will be terribly hard, right? So.
Well, since it's commutative, we just need half of those.
That's a good point, right? Upper ones. Okay. And I believe that answers the whole question, right? So we're supposed to give a basis and we're supposed to write out the product. Right. So that would do number four. Okay, and then we just need one more. All right, so what will we do for number three?
Use CELO?
Yep, so this looks like a CELO problem. Okay, and so the first thing I guess is that 50 is 2 times 5 squared, right? So we have the prime factorization. Okay, and so then what?
We can use that any subgroup of index 2 is normal, so there's just one CELO 5 subgroup.
Exactly. So S5 is the unique. CELO 5 subgroup. Since index 2 subgroups are normal. Okay, so there's only one subgroup of order 25. All right, so then what?
It contains all the elements of order 5.
All right, exactly. So if we have an element of order 5,
Should it be index 2 subgroups or normal?
Yes, did I put it right here? Thank you. Yes, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. So if G has order 5, then it's contained in some 5 Celo group, right? 5 is contained in, and there's only one of those. Hence S5, because that's the only one. Okay, so all the elements of order 5 are sitting inside of this one subgroup S5. All right, so we're almost done. And we're trying to figure out how many of those there are. So what does that leave?
We should consider cases.
Right.
Because the Celo subgroup can be cyclic or product of Z5s.
That's right. And those are the only possibilities, right? The only groups of order P squared are abelian.
Yeah.
So that's the other factorcite. Right, okay, and so we have those two cases. All right, and so then we just have to count the number of elements of order 5 in each of those. And is that quick?
Yeah. Because in a cyclic group, we have one only subgroup of each possible order.
Mm-hmm.
And in the other case, we can see that every non-zero element has order 5.
That's right. So the 24 in that case. Right. Okay, so those are the two possibilities. And I guess the only other thing is to prove that the list is correct. I guess we essentially did that already. Right. I suppose one could try to make sure that there are such groups. Is it clear that there are groups that have these two orders, these two numbers of elements of order 5?
In the cyclic group, we just have one, not 4. I think.
Of order 5?
Yeah.
So there's all the order 5 elements are contained in a C5, which is contained in there? And the non-identity elements of that are order 5, right? So in other words, if I take a generator, so this is generated by A, then I claim that the set A to the fifth.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
A10, yeah. So there will be 4 of them. Right. Okay. Okay, and examples. Are there groups that have these two numbers of elements of order 5?
We can just take direct products to complete the order.
Exactly. So we can take a C2 cross C25 for one of them and C2 cross C5 cross C5 for the other. So they do exist. Okay. Any other thoughts or questions about that one? All right. So that so we got a nice solution for 3. and 2 and 5 and 4. Okay, so that's enough. Okay, and number 1 we talked about a little bit, it's Galois theory. And number 6, any comments or thoughts about that one?
I think that we already solved that one. I'm not sure.
It's quite possible. It's certainly one that one should be familiar with. The character table for D8 is a good thing just to kind of know. Not too big. Oh, I guess they call it D4, but I believe they mean the one with 8 elements. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We did something about it, right? We worked out that it's it has one representation of order 2 and 4 of order 1. About all we didn't do was fill out the actual numbers in the table. Just now. Okay, other comments or questions about this exam? Now we still have 10 minutes, so we could look at one more exam and just very quickly identify 4 that look tractable without going through them in much detail. Okay, so let's just do that.
How much time again do you have for the test?
I think it's 3 hours.
Yeah, I think in some email it says that it's from 9 to noon.
Yeah, that sounds correct. Yeah. Yeah, so considerably more time than we're spending on these exams, right? So you can, this is a quick run through. Okay, but again, let's see, this is the one we also looked at the end of last week. So just a minute to read through and then we can identify 4 that look like they might be tractable and at least a first idea for an attack.
Number 1, just if you use the induced homomorphism from the group action, just only because we've done it a ton and it's been in the homework, that's the only reason why I would say it's very easy.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it's a good method. So just find it. It's an normal subgroup of G, right.
I definitely take back the very. I would never say it's very easy.
Familiar. It's familiar.
Maybe doable.
Familiar problem by now, right? Yes. Okay. Yeah, and certainly want to review again because, as you say, it comes up often, and it's a good technique even if it's not explicitly asked. Okay, very good. Other ones. Oh, sorry, there are some comments there in the chat. Three, 5, and 6, someone suggested. Okay, any other thoughts about ones that might be tractable? Okay, then maybe some just brief thoughts. So if these are, so what about the three? What would be an approach to this?
Using that quotient sort of solvable or exactly. Solvable and subgroups too.
And subgroups, but quotients are going to be, I guess, the most convenient, right? But subgroups is also true. Okay, right. And so we just need to find a two generator group. And I think we talked about this before, right? So the symmetric groups are two generator and they have index two simple and therefore not solvable subgroups. Okay. Okay, very good. Let's see, other ones that people had thoughts about? Let's see, so you said five and six.
Yeah, I think that maybe in five you eventually end up with a solution if you just play around with the properties that we have. Like the results that we have of characters and representation theory.
Yeah, okay.
So okay. I guess that the main two properties that we are going to use is that the sum of the squares of the dimensions equals your draft group and that.
Right. Okay, so that's at least one that we can get started on and it's plausible that'll pan out and give us a solution. All right, let's see, and then six. Right, so B we've talked about, right? And that's probably a useful one to know. Right. And then A is also not too bad. Okay, so those are four, and I guess we're about out of time. So any other thoughts or comments? Okay, very good. All right. Okay, well, I guess we're out of time. So good luck next week and enjoy the weekend.